Welcome to the Maria Heller Show, the internet's original podcast. Since the year 2000, always ahead of the curve, always on your side. A true warrior for truth and justice, Maria and her guests leave nothing out, and no one is off limits. There is only one truth, the rest is lies. Sit back, enjoy the education with a true daughter of Mother Earth. Sharp New York wit, spiritual knowing, and a very dry sense of humor, Maria will dissect the news and lies to make it all palatable. Education is power. Maria delivers rapid-fire truth like no one else can. Here she is, the mouth that roars, the legendary Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to Roaring Truth with my cohort, Jim Fetzer. Jim's been a little under the weather this week, but he's going to do the best he can today. So here we are, ready to roar. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Maria. A lot going on out there.
Oh, absolutely. But before we even get into that, I just want to say that our new show, Born in the 1940s, We Remember, went over especially well. I mean, the audience loves it, and of course, for the audience, we'll be doing it again on the 27th of this month. So I just wanted to let you know that people do appreciate the voice of their elders.
Well, that's very interesting, Maria. I think it's got to be the historical perspective, you know, of learning more about who we are, how we grew up, what we went through, how we have pieced things together and managed to cope with the problems that we encounter in life. I'm very glad to have that kind of sense of appreciation from your audience. That's wonderful.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's especially important because we are pretty much living history. And I don't know if you saw the article, I believe it was South Dakota, that no longer wants to teach American history in their schools. And then you look at Texas changing the textbooks. And, you know, once our voices are gone and our experience is gone, the young people will never know what this country was founded on, what it's about, and what's happened.
Yeah, Texas has long exerted a disproportionate role upon the publication of high school texts because publishers don't want to have two different versions. That's quite a hassle. And only one for distribution, so they tend to respond to what turns out to be the most conservative school boards in the country out of Texas, and thereby does the tail wag the dog. But your point is impeccable about, you know, those of us who have lived through these things. I mean, we know from personal experience lots of details, lots of facts that aren't made generally available to the public. Especially when you have revisionist historians who are presenting false depictions of what actually occurred, where we are doing what we can to set the record straight.
Absolutely, especially when it comes to government conspiracies. I mean, we lived through so many political assassinations. You know, we weren't toddlers in our mother's arms. We were, you know, teenagers. We knew what was happening around us.
Yeah, I was... In 1963, I was 22 when JFK was shot. I would turn 23 the following month, but, you know, I was already a graduate of Princeton and a Marine Corps officer, and it was all just a very, very distressful, though frankly, you know, the political significance of what happened would only dawn on me gradually later. The Marine Corps is highly professional and apolitical. And there really wasn't occasion to reflect much on what had happened, especially when I had learned of his death while anchored out aboard the LPH landing platform helicopter Iwo Jima, which is like a carrier but with a shallow draft because helicopters going up and down don't need that long, stable platform. I'm sure we talked about it during our first conversation, but...
Well, that was...
It's really remarkable in retrospect, you know, how my understanding of events has grown with further research over the years, which has now become quite massive.
Right. And you know what? If we weren't as aged as we are, we wouldn't see all the falsehoods, all the lies, all the government conspiracies, false flags that are out there. Because we grew up at a period where they were at their acme as far as pulling the wool over Americans' eyes. But anyway, we'll save that for our next episode. We have a thunderstorm going here, so if anything blows, don't you just want everybody
to hear it in the background?
I know. Wow. I know. Well, when you live in the mountains, listen, that's how it happens. What I did want to ask you is, and I told you I wasn't going to watch the debates, but I ended up watching the first hour and a half. Then I couldn't take it anymore. And I see that Donald Trump and Ben Carson now are in league saying that if they have rules for their next debate, or they're going to boycott the next debate, especially if it goes over an hour and a half, which isn't a bad idea.
Yeah.
Right.
The problem, of course, wasn't the amount of time. The problem was the number of candidates when you had so many up on the stage. But I think 2 hours is probably a good max. I think 3 hours is trying the patience of the viewers. And their suggestion of having opening and closing statements, I think, is also commendable, except once again, you have so very many candidates.
We'll take up the whole time.
They need to cut down to, you know, about the same number as the Democrats have.
Well, what'd you think of the Democratic debate? I got to tell you, that guy Jim Webb actually frightens me.
Webb came across by far as the most militaristic of the Democratic candidates. I suppose he would have looked pretty normal among most of those Republicans. But yes, and the others didn't make much impact. Hillary handled herself very, very well, but Bernie, you know, it's fascinating. Bernie scored so many important points, and I think Americans are starting to learn something about the nature of socialism, Maria. What they don't understand is they've been propagandized so massively. I was very disappointed in Trump in commenting on it, that he describes Sanders as a socialist communist, as though that were synonymous, because the United States, in many ways, is a socialist country. The programs that have been most successful for the American people, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, those are all forms of socialism. So I think we have to become more sophisticated. And it's, to me, very disappointing that Donald Trump would try to run together the concepts of communism, which can be classically defined as the government owning all the means of manufacturing, industry, and production, versus laissez-faire capitalism, where it's all owned privately. The government owns basically none of it, with what we have here in the United States, which has sometimes been referred to as a mixed economy, but where many of the most important elements are actually socialistic programs that qualify as socialism, where the government is providing, you know, benefits to the people, which seems to me what a government ought to be doing in the first place.
Right. Well, wouldn't you consider Roosevelt then a socialist, because he brought in the New Deal and so many programs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was doing many constructive things that benefited the people by adopting approaches that had not been familiar. But yes, and you know, there are right-wingers who despise Franklin Delano Roosevelt to this day, notwithstanding the immense benefits he brought to the American people, bringing us out of depression, creating the public works projects and all that. We could use some of that today, frankly. I think a massive public works project could put back to work many of the unemployed, whereas you well know, Maria, the statistics that were given by the government are completely contrived, insofar as anyone who has ceased looking for work, they become so discouraged, is no longer counted, where some estimates have it that the unemployment rate is even close to 50%, Maria, that we have, you know, something like 90 million unemployed Americans. That's unbelievable. That's utterly irresponsible.
I agree.
And the administration seems to be completely unwilling to address the full dimensions of the problem or do anything about it.
Right. Well, you know, several years ago, before he died, Bob Chapman, the international forecaster, he used to give out the real unemployment all those years ago, and at that time it was over 23%. And he had predicted we'd be going to 50% unemployment, and he was right.
Well, see, it benefits businesses because then there's so much available labor, they can get it on the cheap. Remember, Milton Friedman, the Nobel-winning economist from the University of Chicago, enunciated the principle that dominates American businesses, which is that the only social obligation of corporations is to maximize the benefits for their stockholders.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you maximize benefits for your stockholders is by minimizing costs in relation to a selling price that's as high as the market will bear, by paying the least wages, the fewest benefits, exploiting natural resources, evading cleanup, pollution, moving your headquarters offshore to evade taxes, creating monopolies. There's something profoundly immoral and corrupt about corporations
right.
when they adhere to the maxim of Milton Friedman, which is widely regarded as the proper principle on the basis of which corporations should conduct their business. Where Marjorie Kelly has published a brilliant book entitled The Divine Right of Capital, in which she explains that we have to reconceive the role of corporations, where the rightness or wrongness of their actions is not measured in terms of profits for their stockholders, but has to take into account the impact of their actions on the environment, on other people, other populations, and so forth, as stakeholders, as individuals or aspects of the environment that have a stake in the actions of the corporation, so that
right.
if polluting is going to, you know, adversely affect the environment, that although it may make a difference to the stockholders by increasing their profits through pollution, it's objectionable and not to be permissible. And where, unfortunately, in this day and age, federal agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency do more to protect the corporations than they do to enforce the laws.
Absolutely. Well, you know, watching the debate, and I knew from the beginning that Bernie Sanders, at the very least, would at least talk about the real issues. And watching him and Hillary, she talks about it, but you know she doesn't mean it. Okay, that to me was the difference. She's such a phony. And when she had the nerve to say that the gun lobby and the gun industry is the only industry that has immunity, I wanted to break the TV. Because who has more immunity than Big Pharma and vaccine companies?
I know. I mean, they recently expanded it when they had the contrived Ebola crisis so that they were no longer liable for adverse effects of vaccines they manufacture, which means they could kill tens or hundreds of thousands of Americans would be perfectly free and clear, which was about as abusive, irresponsible act by the Congress has ever taken. I mean, that means they no longer have to worry about quality control because they're not liable in any case.
Exactly. Let alone that we've seen the bankers are not liable. The police certainly are not liable. And when she said that, I couldn't believe it. And, you know, listening to Bernie's defense of guns, I had to agree with him. Because when he said to her, listen, people in the city have a different view of guns than people who live in rural America. But you're not familiar with rural America, so you don't understand that, was basically what he was saying to her. And I had to learn that difference. You know, look, I grew up in New York City. Okay, nobody had guns. We thought it was a terrible thing. Not a one of us had a thought to have a gun. But when I moved out to the open desert of Arizona and saw everybody carrying a gun and had my own life threatened, then I realized there is a need for guns. Okay, I guess it depends on where you're at. I thought he slapped her down pretty good with that one.
I've been so concerned about the movement to confiscate our weapons, which Obama is pursuing a pace which lay behind Sandy Hook and a host of these other events, which were actually staged. Nobody died at Sandy Hook, for example. I did an interview with a community television program in Seattle, Washington, entitled Truth Versus News, on the topic, do we really need guns? And I go through all the reasons why. I mean, I you know, fit it into the context of the contemporary debate between Trump and Carson and Hillary and so forth.
Right.
And I point out the role of citizen soldiers. I mean, this goes back all the way to the Revolutionary War. It was like the principal reason why the founding fathers incorporated the Second Amendment. So that, you know, citizens could be in a position to come to the aid of the nation. Home defense, what could be more obvious? The reason you call police, if you think there's, say, a burglar trying to break into your home, is that they're going to arrive with guns. But if you have guns, you can defend yourself against potentially being maimed or killed or otherwise abused. You don't have to wait for that delay with the police. To maintain order, if there's a collapse of our government, for example, by a nuclear attack, Maria, law and order would essentially collapse, and if citizens are disarmed, then they're completely vulnerable, for example, to marauding gangs, motorcycle thugs. You recall the Marlon Brando film, The Wild Ones,
right.
Where, you know, these gangs can rape and pillage and loot towns if they're unable to defend themselves, resisting invading armies. The highest-ranking military advisor to Emperor Hirohito advised against invading the United States because there'd be a sniper behind every bush. Personal defense, what could be more obvious? You illustrate that yourself when you were threatened and recognized the need.
Absolutely.
To be able to defend yourself. The NRA had it right years ago, Maria, when it pointed out when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. I mean, the idea of taking weapons away from law-abiding citizens where the criminals aren't going to conform to the law, that's part of what it is for them to be criminals, is going to leave them armed and the population unarmed. The idea of gun-free zones sounds nice in principle, but it's not going to work for the very, very reason that the criminals are still going to have their own weapons. And I was astonished with the Oregon shooting, which it also appears to me to have been a fake, that the principal, when asked afterwards whether she was going to change any of her security arrangements because the school was identified as a gun-free zone, said, oh, no, you know, that was just an anomaly. We're going to stay exactly the way we are. And yet if you had, you know, some students or teachers or guards who are armed, nothing like that could take place. I mean, it would be quickly brought to a halt.
Right. Well, you know, years ago,
I think some of the discussion about gun control is frankly absurd, Maria.
I agree.
And when they claim, by the way, that having fewer guns means fewer crimes, the evidence contradicts it. It turns out when they imposed gun laws in the UK and Australia, there was a surge in the number of homicides. And even that argument is seriously flawed. You can see the obvious reason.
Right.
If everyone has guns, when someone tries to commit a crime with a gun, there are others there who are armed to oppose them.
Right. So, I agree.
I hope everyone will check out Do We Really Need Guns? Truth Versus News, 15 October. It's out there on the internet.
Well, you know, years ago, I remember reading a story, and I know it was in Georgia, where two towns in Georgia tried an experiment, and no one had a choice. They had to do it. They totally disarmed one town, and the other town, they had every adult member of the family go for gun lessons and arm. Each household was armed. Needless to say, you can tell where the rise in crime happened during that experiment. It certainly wasn't where they knew there was a skilled person with a gun in every house. So when you look at this, and listen, I've known lots of criminals in my life. None of them go to a gun store to buy a gun, okay? They're not going to go for a background check. They buy hot guns. I mean, you see it on TV all the time, you know, is the serial number wiped off or whatnot. So, I'm not pro anything, but again, it's pro-choice. But when they took away the guns in the UK, I had a report, I believe last year in the UK, they had 130,000 stabbings. So people are going to find a way, especially in China, they like to stab each other too. People have always found a way to kill each other since Cain and Abel, since he killed his brother with a rock. You know what I mean? So looking at Bernie...
Well, what disturbs me is that the highest leaders of our government are giving us false information and promoting gun control, which suggests that they have an agenda to disarm the American people.
Yeah, it's people control.
We have to be armed to resist the tyranny of our own government. I'm sorry to have to conclude, but Barack Obama has not been acting in the best interest of the American people. And for him to have taken an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States from all enemies, foreign and domestic, and then take so many steps to undermine the Second Amendment, to me, is ironclad proof that he's violated his oath and actually is committing an impeachable offense.
Right. Well, you know, when you look at, I was reading that he wants to pass an executive order to change gun laws. When you look at, and you remember, I remember, do you remember Bush Sr. when he wanted to suspend the Constitution when he was working with Oliver North? Ollie North had said the only reason he didn't was because he knew Oliver North said to Bush, Americans are too well armed and they won't stand for it.
Yeah.
So if we had been disarmed at that point, I guess the One World Order would have taken over a whole lot earlier. Because wasn't Bush Sr. the one who talked about the One World Order first?
Yes, he's talked so much about a New World Order. And, you know, frankly, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is its embodiment. It entails, do you know that a part of that is giving the right to remove someone's website without any formal process or procedure? You know, this is a way they're going to come after people like you and me who are critics of the government, who turn out to be now classified, you know, as some kind of threats, as supporting terrorism, as terrorists, like veterans. Veterans are among those that the government regards as potential terrorists. How absurd. But, of course, it's because they're qualified with weapons. They know how to use them. And the government wants to do something to neutralize or nullify veterans. I believe this was a large part of Jade Helm, which, by the way, I regard as simply gone into a dormant stage. They did this as a pilot project, it now appears, to see how far they could go and what they could get away with and what forms of information distribution would take place so they can plan to take those out in the future, so the people will have much, much less idea or understanding of what's around them.
Right. Well, I guess Jade Helm, like I had told you, you know, when we expose these things in advance, it forces them to retreat. And I believe that that's what happened. So many, even governors, were talking against Jade Helm that they had no option except to tone it down. But, you know, when you look at how many cops are killing Americans, there are over 700 Americans murdered, judge, jury, and executioner. That's what cops are. Imagine what they would do if we were all unarmed. I mean, they have no restrictions, you know. They kill old people, young people, children, cats, dogs. If you make a finger puppet that looks like a gun, they'll shoot you dead. Chapstick in your pocket. Some guy got shot this week for his wallet. So if they can mistake a wallet for a gun, imagine what would happen to us if we couldn't defend ourselves.
I know, it's appalling. And, you know, when they talk about common sense, what could be more obvious than that if you're going to resist an armed opponent, you need to be armed yourself? So, you know, and Hillary's talking about passing laws that make gun manufacturers liable for the misuse of their products. I mean,
that's ridiculous.
That is about as outrageous as it gets, Maria.
I agree.
Ridiculous.
I agree. Jim, I got to tell you this. Roger Stone, I just got his latest book from his publisher. And I don't know if you've even seen it yet, because it's like truly hot off the presses. And he calls it the Clintons' War on Women. What he has revealed in this book, and he's got another book coming out in January about Jeb Bush and the Bush family. So he's getting these two in his sights before the election. When I read, you know, when publishers send you a book, I'm sure you know, you always have cheat sheets in the book. And just reading the cheat sheets, I put down the book I was reading and started reading this last night. I got into 105 pages of it before my eyes got too tired. Hillary has no chance in hell if this book becomes a bestseller of getting elected. No chance in hell. It's astounding.
The title again, Maria?
It's The Clintons' War on Women. And he says that Hillary Clinton is no fan of women, and he talks about all the women that she threatened to stay quiet, lives ruined, calling the orders on Bill Clinton's girlfriends and women that he raped to intimidate them into silence. Incredible.
It's interesting because Bill Clinton has observed that Hillary has slept with more women than he has.
Well, there's so much that I can't wait, because there's things I did not know. You know, just when you think you know so much, you always keep realizing you really don't know all that much. First of all, he contends that Chelsea is not Bill Clinton's daughter and puts a picture of her up with who he says is her real father.
Webster Hubble.
Right, and she is the picture of him. Talks about the fact that Chelsea had so much plastic surgery to try to change her features in her 20s, so she didn't look
who had her father. Who had plastic surgery?
Chelsea. And he's got he's got before and after pictures of how she tried to change her face so she wouldn't look so much like this guy Hubble.
Regardless of her parentage, she oughtn't to be attempting to change her features. That's really unbelievable.
Well, I never considered her a pretty girl. But I did not know that Bill Clinton has a son who's half black and 5 grandchildren that he won't acknowledge.
Fascinating.
And that Bush Sr. knew about it when Clinton was running against him and chose not to use that information.
Is the book out now?
Yeah, it's out now. I'm holding it in my hand so I didn't forget to tell you some of the stuff. He co-wrote it with Robert Morrow.
Good.
Unfortunately, the person that blurbs the front of the book is Ann Coulter, who I don't even think is a human being. But I have to tell you, that... So far, up to
there's some question about Ann's Adam apple, which is an anatomical feature of males.
Oh, she gets
an interesting question.
Well,
now again, she makes some important pronouncements that are right-headed. So she doesn't bother me like some of the other mischief makers out there.
Oh, they all bother me.
O'Reilly, for example, who trades so much in falsehood, like 80 to 90% of the time.
Well, I did not know that Bill Clinton, who's supposedly a Rhodes Scholar, was kicked out of Oxford because he raped a 19-year-old girl.
No, you're kidding.
No, I'm telling you, this book is a hair raiser. I couldn't believe it. I said, oh my God, another big, thick book by Roger Stone. I didn't even get to his last one on Nixon. But as soon as I read the blurbs...
His book on LBJ as being the key to the JFK assassination is spot on.
Oh, yeah, I interviewed him on that.
I interviewed Roger Stone before about that book, and he's very good. I like him.
Right. And then, his association with the pedophile, Bill Epstein, how many trips he took to what they call Orgy Island. I mean, this book is a sizzler.
Oh, my God.
I'm telling you that. And he will get into the murders and, how many times Clinton was in drug rehab. abandoning his African-American son, and Hillary, how she used heavy-handed private detectives to collect information on Bill's victims and then silence them. This is probably going to break the bank. If any book should go to bestseller before this election, this one needs to. But he did say, in all fairness, he's taken on Jeb Bush in the book he brings out in January.
Well, Jeb is a worthy target, too. I mean,
but he talks about the collusion of the two families. These two families have been in bed together forever.
Yeah, I think it's good it's being exposed. I think that's terrific.
I know.
I'll pick up the book, too, Maria. We can talk about it next time around.
Oh, absolutely. I won't be putting it down. I switched out what I was reading right away. I said, okay, this book can wait. This one looks too juicy not to read. Because everything about her, she's like the Iron Lady. And, of course, you know, listen, there's been more than rumors about her and her best friend that travels with her being gay. But the way they talk about her anger and her filthy mouth and her name-calling to her husband and constantly having to defend his latest rape. And he's even got pictures of Clinton in there with Bill Cosby and calling birds of a feather.
God. That whole Cosby thing has been unbelievably disappointing, Maria. We grew up with him as an admirable figure, and he turns out to be a disgrace.
Well, you know, listen, it's like that guy Jimmy Savile in the UK. He had a children's show. He's one of the biggest pedophiles going with the royal family and everything. And when David Icke exposed him 20 years ago, everybody said David was crazy, but now even Roger Stone is naming these, was it Prince Edward, I think, that was also good friends with Epstein? They were all pedophiles with girls, you know, 2 and 3, you know, 13-year-old girls at a time.
It's just pathetic, Maria.
Well, then you understand the
social... It's also disgusting. You know, I cannot understand the attraction of having sex with a child with someone who isn't an adult who wants to have sex with you. I don't understand that at all.
I don't either.
It's often described as an act of violence rather than of sex, one of control.
Of course.
Pedophilia, I mean, this is, you know, pathetic that somebody is such an inadequate human being that they have to prey on innocent children for sexual gratification.
It's beyond obscene,
Maria.
But, you know, normal people can't understand that because we don't have the minds of a sociopath. But what he calls them in the book, he calls it, it's a phenomenon known as elite deviance, where people think the normal rules of society no longer apply to them because they're well insulated.
Yes.
Elite deviance. Yes. I have to try to memorize that one because that's a good one.
Yeah.
But he also talked about Waco, Texas, learned something new that I did not know. All these years I've been blaming it on Janet Reno. But he said that it was the attack on Waco, where most of the victims were women, since Hillary's supposed to be pro-women, women and children. Well, that Hillary called the last shot on it. It was her decision for them to hit Waco. She made a lot of the decisions.
How did she even become a part of the chain of command?
Because when she was married to her husband, she made a lot of policy. She had a whole lot more sway on what he did than people realized. And that's what he opens up the book with. The victims, most of the victims were women. 18 children younger than 8, 2 were unborn babies, and he's saying that it was Hillary, it was her decisions.
And the ATF was conducting an assault on the compound. They ran a tank into it, they put it on fire, they were using automatic weapons. It was another disgrace.
Right, and people say, oh, our government would never kill its own people. How many times did we hear that after 9/11?
Ridiculous.
I know. But either way, I mean, it's a hair raiser. So when I get halfway through, I'm going to book Roger for my show. It won't take me long, but I mean...
He's excellent. He's an excellent person.
And Jim, he's got to have no less than 60 pages in annotations of where he gets his information in the back of the book. So the book's not as thick as I thought it was.
Excellent.
You know, it reminds me of Kitty Kelly when I interviewed her on the book she did exposing the Bush family. Barbara Bush at the time had called every TV station and said, if you interview Kitty Kelly on this book, you'll never get a Bush on any of your news shows ever again.
That sounds like a benefit.
That's what I say, the Iron Lady. But, you know, Kitty Kelly, you know she always offers a reward of 20 grand for anybody that can prove anything in her book is not true. Nobody ever sued her or collected on it.
I know, it's amazing. For someone who's classified as a tabloid journalist, she seems to hit them out of the park time and time again.
I know, and then, you know, their loss was my gain because in those years, you know, who was Maria Heller to get Kitty Kelly on her show? But because she couldn't get coverage anywhere else, I was able to get her on my show, and I mean, we tore into her book, and it was great.
Wonderful, wonderful, Maria.
Worked for me. Jim,
let's
take a short break. Stay with us. Jim and I will be right back.
She's been called Paula Revere, the mother of the internet and even a legend. The mouth that roars, roars all truth without any input from corporate, religious, or political affiliations. Rhea's in it just like you are. Often imitated but never duplicated. Commercial-free talk providing a real education in a world filled with lies, cover-ups, and propaganda. Subscribe now and encourage your friends to do the same. Feel good about supporting real media that supports you and all life on this planet. Pick a subscription of your choice and get started on the journey down the rabbit hole. If you are financially challenged or a senior on a limited income, please send an email to maria@maria.net and she will work something out for you. There's never been a more dangerous or exciting time to be alive. Education is a necessity now. Stay informed. Subscribe today at www.meria.net.
Welcome back to Roaring Truth with myself and Professor Jim Fetzer. And we're talking about all kinds of things today from two realistic point of views from people that have actually lived lives instead of learned about it from books written by other people. We are coming up on the next anniversary of the murder of John Kennedy. And I've noticed that, Jim, that there's a lot of information now going around online. I see Judith Vary Baker using social media defending Lee Harvey Oswald. And I know that there's been a lot of discussion about Lee Harvey Oswald being the man in the doorway of the building, and not where they say he was.
Yes, yes, yes. Judith's done some brilliant work on this, which I will explain. There's a very famous photograph, probably the most famous, taken during the assassination by an AP photographer by the name of James Ike Alchins, where you can see the limousine in the foreground, the Secret Service men looking around. JFK is actually clutching his throat. In the background, you can see the Daltex building. And if you know where to look, there's actually a window there framed by the fire escape from which three were fired. The only unsilenced shots that were fired during the assassination were at least 8, 9, or 10 were fired altogether from 6 or more different locations. And where in the background to the left, you see the doorway, the entrance to the book depository, and there's a figure who seems to be extending out looking at what's going on. Well, researchers from Harold Weisberg to Jim Garrison believe that that was Lee Oswald in the doorway. And a fellow by the name of Ralph Sinquet has organized a group called the Oswald Innocence Campaign, you can find online, in which he discusses the evidence for Oswald in the doorway, about which I myself have published at least 20 articles, Maria.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have here when you do a close-up is you see in the doorway area, there's a man in the doorway that so seems to resemble Lee Oswald. There's a figure behind him, though oddly, he's both behind him and in front of him at the same time. So the man in the doorway is actually missing his left shoulder. Then there's a fellow beside him with his arms raised over his head whose face is completely obscure. It's been painted out in black.
Uh-huh.
And just within, you know, his arm, there's another face that's been totally obscured by scratching out the face. Now, when I first learned that Lee Oswald had told Will Fritz, the homicide investigator, interrogating him, that he'd been out with Bill Shelley in front, where Bill Shelley was his supervisor, it made me take another look at this issue, and I discovered a collage on the website of a fellow by the name of John McAdams, who's notorious for defending the Warren Commission report in spite of the mountain of evidence against it. And in that collage, he had circled the face of the man. Well, you could see very clearly the obfuscated face, which led me to infer that that person with the obfuscated face must have been Lee Oswald, because otherwise, why would anyone obfuscate a face in such an important photograph unless it was someone who shouldn't have been there? Mm-hmm. But I published an article about it on the occasion of the 48th observance under the title JFK, What We Know Now That We Didn't Know Then, and included that photograph with the obfuscated face circled. I was contacted by Ralph Sinkay, who was, in fact, a chiropractor, and told me that actually it wasn't the facial features that mattered. It was the height, the weight, the build, the clothing, the fit of the clothing that mattered. And indeed, when we did a comparison between Lee Oswald when he was arrested and the image of the doorman, the height, the weight, the build, the shirt, the T-shirt, all bear a striking correspondence. Mm-hmm. Now, the government has claimed that the person in the doorway was actually Billy Lovelady, but who himself said he thought it was odd people would mistake him and Lee because he was 2 to 3 inches shorter and 15 to 20 pounds heavier. But Billy does appear to have been in the doorway. He appears to be the figure with his hands upraised, which is why his face was blacked out, so you couldn't see more readily that it was Billy Lovelady. And he's wearing a short sleeve shirt. Now, that's very, very important, because, of course, doorman is wearing a long sleeve shirt of a very rich texture. Billy was asked by the FBI to come in on 29 February 1964 wearing the shirt he had worn that day. And it was a short sleeve, red and white, vertically striped shirt, strikingly different than the shirt of doorman. Uh-huh. What has happened subsequently is that those who are trying to obfuscate the fact that Oswald was in the doorway, for which we have overwhelming evidence, including a new proof that's absolutely masterful, have suggested he was wearing actually a red and black checkered shirt, because there was a figure in the crowd in the doorway area who was wearing a red and black checkered shirt. So that even some well-known students of JFK, including, for example, Robert Grodin, has taken photographs of Billy Lovelady wearing a checkered shirt. But there are lots and lots of oddities here. Judah did a comparison of by a pixel study, doing a close-up of the pixelation of the shirt Lee Oswald was wearing when he was arrested and the shirt on doorman. And the red and black checkered shirt that, you know, the apologists claim Billy was actually wearing. Now, there's a fascinating background to this, because Robert Grodin was hired as a special consultant to the House Select Committee on Investigations when it reinvestigated the case in 1977-78 to determine whether the figure in the doorway was Billy Lovelady or Lee Oswald. And he reported back to them that the pattern on the Lovelady shirt, now I'm talking about the red and black checkered shirt, more closely resembled the pattern of the doorman shirt than did Lee Oswald's shirt. Judith, in her pixelation study, discovered precisely the opposite to be the case, and that the pixelation study showed that the Oswald shirt bore a striking similarity, and the Lovelady shirt a striking dissimilarity. It's very stunning. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that all the evidence supports that it was Lee Oswald in the doorway. Now we have a new study by a fellow named Larry Rivera, who's done some brilliant work on it. And he created a GIF that he found photographs of both Billy Lovelady and Lee Oswald that were comparable to the angle of the face and doorman. Now, most of them were from the opposite side. So we flipped both of them to the opposite side because faces are highly symmetrical. Mm-hmm. And then he created a gif of sequentially bringing the face in behind the face of Doorman. And would you believe when he did it with Oswald, it was astonishing, Maria. It was a virtually exact fit. And when he did it with Billy Lovelady, it was completely different, not a good fit. So we have now the latest proof, and you can find it available, for example, on this the blog of Ralph Sinquet, the article by Larry Rivera, if I can get my cursor to work. Hmm. It's entitled Oswald in the Doorway, the blog of the Oswald Innocence Campaign. But here, the article just appeared about Larry Rivera's proof. And you're going to find this many places because it's going to be very, very widely broadcast. I mean, this is quite stunning. And what it means, of course, is we now have, you know, what I regard as virtually definitive proof. This is objective, scientific, it can be replicated, mm-hmm. and Oswald was indeed in the doorway, as we had already determined, but now further verified by means of this new form of proof, so that not only was he not the lone gunman, he cannot even have been one of the shooters, and indeed, the six shooters I have identified, three of whom have ties to the CIA, include a Dallas deputy sheriff firing from the top of the county records building, an Air Force expert firing from the vicinity of the triple underpass and shot the pass through the windshield before it hit JFK in the throat, an anti-Castro Cuban who was firing from the Dow Tax 3 shots with the M. Silas Vandeker Cacano, two of which missed, which hit the curbing, distant curbing and injured a bystander, by the name of James Tang, another missed and hit the chrome ship and shield. The third of which, however, hit JFK in the back of the head during the limousine stop, where William Greer brought the limousine to a halt. JFK slumped forward, Jackie eased him back up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible or exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out the back of his head with such force that when they hit Officer Hargis riding there, he himself thought he had been shot. That was fired by Frank Sturgis, who was a CIA mob guy, who even admitted having fired that shot to New York Gold Shield Detective Jim Rothstein when he arrested him in New York, where he came to kill Marita Lorenz to ensure she not testify before the House Select Committee on Assassination. Plus, there was another police officer on the Knoll who had ties with the CIA, shot appears to have missed, and then Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman was in the book depository, not on the east side from which Oswald was alleged to have fired, where no shots appear to have been fired from there, but the opposite side, the west, firing at John Connally in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarborough, a liberal Texas senator that Lyndon despised. Where there had been a huge argument between JFK and LBJ that morning, where Lyndon wanted to get Connally out and Yarborough in, mm-hmm. and JFK overruled him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. There wasn't time to let the assassins know that it was going to be Connally in terms of instead of Yarborough, and the fact is, Maria obfuscated the politics because it made it much less obvious that Lyndon Johnson, who had played the pivotal role, would have, you know, allowed his closest political ally, John Connally, be the target of an assassination. It's all ironic. Mm-hmm. Larry Rivera, by the way, also discovered that the motorcycle patrolman had given interviews to a fellow named Fred Newcomb back in 1970-71. And on the basis of that interview, those interviews, he reconstructed what happened. After they all confirmed the limousine stop, after the limousine came to a halt and Officer Hargis had been hit by that debris, he dismounted. He ran in between the two limousines up the grassy knoll from which he believed shots had been fired. Officer Douglas Jackson on the right motored up the grassy knoll in pursuit of the same gunman. When his bike tipped over, he continued on foot. Five Secret Service agents dismounted from the Queen Mary, the Secret Service Cadillac, and surrounded the presidential limousine. One of them took a chunk of JFK's skull from a little boy and threw it in the back of the limousine. So, you know, all these things were taking place while the limousine was motionless, mm-hmm. which has led me to reassess the length, the duration of the limo stop from a few seconds to as many as 20 to 30. Yeah, I'm unable to see how all that could have taken place in less time than that, which means, of course, the Zapruder film has been even more massively edited than we had heretofore supposed.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, like you said, you were in your 20s. You know, I was a teenager. I already knew, you know, just looking at it, you know, from the get-go that we were getting sold up the river and it was a bullshit story. And when people say, well, you know, why are you still focusing on that, which they now say, why are you still focusing on 9/11? You have to know history so you can see what they're doing to us. And you can understand that our elections have meant absolutely nothing since the assassination of Kennedy.
I know. The government continues to try to deny. This is where Roger Stone's earlier book is quite brilliant. Phil Nelson has published a piece entitled LBJ, Mastermind of the JFK Assassination. And when you go through the history of Lyndon Johnson and discover how ambitious and narcissistic and ruthless and unprincipled a man he was, mm-hmm. he was a master manipulator. He brooked no opposition, forced himself on the ticket in Los Angeles. He wasn't even on Bobby or Jack's long list, Maria, much less short.
Right.
And he threatened to expose that JFK had had dalliances with women who are spies for other countries. In fact, Frank Sturgis told Jim Rothstein that was one of the reasons he shot JFK, that he suffered from Addison's disease and wasn't expected to live a long, healthy life, and that if he were not on the ticket, that in the position of majority leader of the Senate, he'd bottle up any legislative proposals coming down from the White House, which would be dead on arrival. Jack, who had already extended the invitation to be his running mate to Stuart Symington in Missouri, were flummoxed. They couldn't figure any way out of it and reluctantly had to accept Lyndon on the ticket.
Yeah, but they wanted to get rid of him on re-election, and he knew it. So his clock was running out, and he was on his way to jail.
Lyndon's wealthy supporters broke into the Johnson suite, cursing and swearing that Lyndon was running with JFK. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained exactly what they had in mind. And the fellow came smiles and said he thought that was an excellent plan.
Crazy world. And there you have it. Well, Jim, we're almost out of time. I did want to congratulate you on your article in Press TV on Syria being, you know, war crimes. As usual, war crimes are us. And I was glad to see them refer to you as an American scholar. I've said they should refer to you as an American treasure.
You're very kind, Marie, and I do so enjoy our conversations. I think it's wonderful. I think you're doing terrific for the American public, and I appreciate it greatly.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens between now and next month's Roaring Truth, but I am looking forward to our We Remember show in 2 weeks. So we'll be filling you in on some more background. Everybody was like, okay, now we know all about Jim. What about you? I was like, oh, my God, it would take about 10 years to describe my crazy life. But we'll give it a shot.
The short version.
All right. Well, you take good care of yourself and feel better, Jim. Thanks.
Thanks, Bria. Thanks so much.
Bye. Professor Jim Fetzer. Check out his work at jimfetzer.blogspot.com. Veterans Today. Jim, just put his name in any search engine. You're going to get lots and lots of work. He's got to have, I don't know, at least 20 books out. And We Remember. I don't know how many more times I can hashtag We Remember, but we do remember, and thus we are a threat. People that remember, people that think. Now I see people that eat healthy are also considered mentally ill. The scientists pushing for anybody speaking against climate change to be prosecuted. This is the world we've inherited since 1963. So why did it matter? Because of the world we live in today, just like exposing the truth about 9/11. Anyway, thanks for supporting the show. If you don't have a subscription, why not? If you're a senior on limited income, just send me an email. We'll work something out. Donations are always welcome, and I will see you guys back here on Monday when I'm back with news of Planet of the Apes. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.